Welcome to So What Are You Reading Podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie.
And I'm Alicia.
And today we are going to be talking about the history of Langston Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit about the Harlem Renaissance.
Yes.
I feel like we keep bringing it up.
Yep, we definitely bring it up. These are, you know, beacons of the Harlem Renaissance.
Our last few Black authors in their Black author series have been Harlem Renaissance OGs.
Very much, yeah.
So we're going to talk about that a little bit. But first, of course, what are you reading, Lee? Are you still reading Diary?
Yeah, I'm still reading Diary. I've had to... So, like, I recently came across some, like, Chuck Palahniuk, like, I guess, analyses of his work and like, just how he likes to write.
Oh, nice.
So I'm reading it kind of differently.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they... Like, I guess I didn't know this because I'd only seen Fight Club, the movie, not read Fight Club, the books. And it turns out that, like, that is an allegory. Of course, I figured it was an allegory. I just didn't know for what, because it was a little too deep and I'd seen it a little too young. So, like, you know, it's just an allegory for, like, you know, being in the closet, basically.
Yeah.
So that's what Fight Club is about. And I'm like, okay, cool. So I was just going through that. Diary came up. I kind of started reading that. And I'm like, I don't want to give up, you know. If there's spoilers in here, I don't want to know them.
Right. You don't want to ruin the book for yourself.
But it is making me read it differently because I know that the subcontext is huge. So, I don't know. I've just been trudging along. It's kind of cool. Good book to read every time I open it. There's not like a moment of like wasted space on the page. Like everything's important. So, I'm really into it.
Nice.
Yes.
Nice.
Got a little further last night. But,
oh, good.
Yeah. After all that. Yesterday, with the Tito's, I was out.
There was no reading getting done after that.
I probably got like 8 pages, and I'm like,
I should put this down.
Yep. Why is the book reading me?
Right.
Okay, what are you reading?
I am reading the Spook Show Book 11.
Yes.
The Spiritualist and Medium. And so we find out that, I don't know if I said this in the beginning, but in this book, Billy finds out that her mom had an arrest warrant issued to her.
Mm.
Or she had a charge. She was arrested for assaulting a police officer like 3 days before she went missing.
Oh.
And so Billy wants to find out, like, what happened to this, why she got this charge, because she doesn't remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And so she asks her Aunt Maggie, and her Aunt Maggie tells her, Billy, like, yeah, you were there, like, this happened, but Billy's, like, doesn't remember it
she
at all. She
must have
blacked it out, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So she goes to Gantry, you know, John Gantry, and his girlfriend Cordelia, she's like, Cordelia's like a ghost, I don't know how to explain her. She's like a witch ghost type of person. She's like 150 years old, but she's not dead. But she can't leave the house. She's trapped at the house where they live at. The house
she's
is
like kind of dead.
Yeah, she's ice. Everyone says she's ice cold.
Oh, gross.
But she had a feeling that something was going on with Billy because they're really good friends. And so Billy comes to her, and they want to find out what happened back then. So she goes to Cordelia, and Cordelia does like this kind of spell with a lock of Billy's mom's hair that she had been saving, and she like travels back, and that's how they're like kind of gonna find out, because it tells the story of that those days leading up to her mom's disappearance. So that's kind of how they.
I just need to know
the story.
What the very last interaction was that Billy's mom had with like either law enforcement or whoever it was that, like, is the cause of this warrant. Because, like, what were the charges again?
So it was assaulting a police officer. So they kind of do a little bit of investigating before they go to John Gantry. Like, because Ray Mokler, Billy's boyfriend, is a detective.
Mm-hmm.
So they do a little bit of investigating, and they find out who the cop was that said he assaulted her.
Mm-hmm.
And they track him down.
Like, is he the arresting officer? Like, what's the dealio?
They track him down, and he's like, I don't really remember. He's like, I remember Mary Agnes because she was a hothead in town, and like, she was the psychic.
Was she an Aries?
That everybody. What are you trying to say?
I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying, whenever someone is like, oh, they're really loud, I'm like, Aries.
Don't do us Aries like that.
y'all doing yourselves like that.
No.
Because they don't say that about me.
Mm-hmm. But he says he remembers her, but he doesn't remember that charge.
Mm-hmm.
So then when they go into his house, Billy, like, she touches something on it, and like a name pops in her head, Lori, and she says, "Who's Lori?" And then his eyes get really, really big, and he's like, "You guys need to leave."
Mm.
And so that's kind of where that is, where I left off there. So he clearly knows something. 'Cause
like already I'm thinking like whoever was on this case, somebody picked her up to arrest mm-hmm. her, drove her out into the middle of the snow, and then just dumped her there. Like, it's weird.
Yeah.
It's giving cover up.
Yes, it's definitely giving cover up.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since this charge was like in the back of a file cabinet, like way in the back.
Very strange.
In a, like a box of other loose papers and stuff.
Loose papers.
So it's
they didn't even got no files.
Right.
Suspicious.
So
I'm no folders.
I'm excited to see where this is gonna lead, because like I said, this has been like the background story throughout all of the books.
Okay.
It's what happened to Billy's mom, because she just disappears.
She saw somebody do something.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's why I don't be looking at things. I've seen enough.
I don't need to be a witness.
I can't see. I'm telling. I can't see. Like,
don't you see these glasses? I can't see.
People be like, "You didn't see any. You're what?
You're right.
What? See what, sir?
You're correct. I did not see
nothing happened. Are you good? Like, yeah. I'm gonna gaslight you because I didn't see it. You cannot say
that you saw me.
Yep. Until
seeing something.
That is until I get picked up.
Yeah, because then I'm going to say I seen something. Because the first to squeal gets
I
the deal.
I seen him right there. He's still wearing the boots.
You ain't still wearing me, the... Then I seen it for sure. Yo, I seen
what?
It.
Like, you're going to look at my interrogation footage. It's going to be me with like a big old crab leg boil that the cops gave me in exchange for my testimony.
You seen that meme where that guy had that big ass bucket of chicken?
Me.
From the...
That's
like,
me.
Oh, he done told.
Yes, or that Key and Peele episode where like the dude is in the, like the thugs in the interrogation room, and you just see him with steaks and lobsters.
Yeah,
he got a toy truck. He was riding out, and he was like, and he keeps coming out to the guy in the hallway, and the guy's like, "You ain't telling, right?" He was like, nah, man, they just need me for a little bit longer, and they like bringing in food, like Jesus. They done bought him shoes and stuff. Me.
Yes.
I would have owned that government building by the end of it.
Yeah, I'm not going to jail.
Especially if it was good. I need immunity forever from all crimes so that I can change my salary to $1 million a day. And then I'm only going to work 2 more days because I only need 2 million. I can live off 2 million for the rest of my life. I don't care. Maybe, okay, I might work another week and a half. I don't know. But, like, I'm telling.
Period. I'm for sure going to tell, though.
Yeah, so I would have went missing, like Mary Billy's
Agnes.
Mom.
You old Mary Agnes.
Sorry, Mary Agnes. I didn't understand you, girl.
So we're going to find out. I'm excited to find out. And now she's like, I've been in the chapters where it's like the point of view is from Mary Agnes's point of view now.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kind of a dumb bitch.
Okay.
She kind of annoyed me because like, she don't got much. And, like, her sister bought Billy this bike. And she's like, oh, you bought Billy this bike? You think you better than me? Bitch, I bought your daughter a bike.
I am kind of... I'm doing well. Because I didn't have to buy this fucking bike.
And she got it from, like, a garage sale and fixed it up. It ain't like she went and bought her a brand new bike. Like,
oh, yeah.
You're doing too
much. She gets a little cookie.
Yeah.
She can have a little cookie.
So...
Because if you do want to say the, you know, better than you Olympics, like, mm-hmm. I'm going to beat you down with that.
But I think Mary Agnes is going to see something or hear something because she gets a lot of customers that come to her but, like, don't want people to know that they go to her because, you know, it's just, like, a small town. They're in Hamilton, Ontario, or in Canada. I'm probably saying that wrong.
Canadians?
Yeah.
Let us know.
They're in Hamilton. That's the name of the town. I don't know if that's...
Is that real?
I'm pretty sure it's real because I listened to a Canadian true crime podcast and they refer to that town.
Okay. Whenever I listen to my true crime podcast, we in Toronto.
Yeah.
Period.
But.
I don't know what Toronto is like for y'all.
I think she's going to have heard something from somebody's wife or something, because there's a couple of customers where they said like their wives come and the husbands don't really approve.
Mm.
So I feel like that's going to happen.
But like, what's the nature of the business though? I don't feel like it warrants all of that. Is it because she's a spirit medium? Like,
yeah, because they be going to her like looking for like.
Okay. I mean, to me, I would equate that to being the same as like if my homegirl told me that she goes to a fortune teller. Like, right. It's not that serious.
Mm-hmm.
So what's all the hoopla for?
Yeah.
As far as like they don't want their husband. Like, man, nigga, I'm going to the fortune teller. Stop playing with me. Give me some cash. She only take cash. Like, do you want some fried fish on the way home? Because you know her place is right by the
fried fish place.
You know what I mean? But that's just me.
Because that's what I'm getting for dinner. What are you going to
get? You know what I mean? On my way home. Like, am I what? Because I'm going to the fortune teller.
Right. So I'm excited to find out what happens to Billy's mom.
Damn. Billy's mom. Maybe she's fine. Maybe she just abandoned her kid.
I don't think
so. Sucks for Billy. But that'd be good news, right? I don't know. Maybe not.
I don't think so.
Maybe it's better if she is dead. You better be. You've been gone so long.
All this time and you have been.
You
oh
better
my God,
be dead, bitch.
I'll be fucking so mad.
You're right. Yeah. That would piss me off.
That'd be like, that's what happened in Blade. I'm just saying.
You're right. I had to think about it. I was like, in Blade. Oh, yeah. And that's what always happens in anime, too. Like, somebody's going to find their long-lost dad. Like, they think that they're an orphan or whatever. It turns out that dude in the mountain, he's just been training.
Yeah.
In mixed martial arts.
And they've been around the
to fight his childhood enemy. Like, he left you.
He abandoned you.
Yeah, no, literally. To go train somewhere, hone his power, and become, like, the greatest fighter in the world over here. You, like, eating out of garbage cans.
Right.
And now you can fight better than him.
Mm-hmm.
Most anime, actually.
Well, I hope that's not what happened to Billy's mom. I hope
that's
she
what
finds
happened.
Out.
She's training.
She's probably.
No, she definitely got murked.
Yeah, for sure. So that's what I'm reading. Other than that, I've just been reading that. I'm trying to just stick to one book because if I feel like I've been reading two books, I'm just not finishing them.
Yeah, that's me right now too. And then like the way Diary is set up, it means like a lot of my.
Mm-hmm.
Not, I mean, I don't want to make people think this is some, like, dense-ass read. It's not. But, like, it does take, like, I have
to
be paying
focus.
Attention.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can't do my normal, like, quick, you know,
yeah.
kind of reading three words per sentence kind of reading and still get it. I have to read it.
Really sit and focus.
Mm-hmm. Especially when they bring up stuff, like, because they mix timelines a lot in mm-hmm. the book. So, if you're not paying attention, she'll be recalling a past event.
Right.
You know, in the present, but we're still in that present time. Mm-hmm. Like, if she were to be standing, like, you know, on the bow of a boat, she's recalling something from high school, mm-hmm. but we're still in that scene. It's kind of weird. Not weird. It happens all the time. But in book form, it can be a little confusing if you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
Because he's not telling you the transitions. Like, now back to high school.
Right.
Like, he's not doing that. Yeah.
All right, so we are going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we're going to get into the history of Langston Hughes. All right, we are going to get into the history of Langston Hughes. Langston Hughes was the primary contributor to the Harlem Renaissance. He was one of the first to use jazz rhythms in his work, becoming an early innovator of literary art form and jazz poetry. While many American poets during the 1920s were writing esoteric poetry to a dwindling audience, Hughes addressed people using languages, themes, attitudes, and ideas that they could relate to. As a prolific writer, known for his colorful portrayals of Black lives in the 1920s through the 1960s, Hughes wrote plays, short stories, poetry, several books, and contributed to the lyrics on Broadway and a Broadway musical. In addition to his extensive body of work, he inspired other artists and highlighted the power of art as a catalyst for change. Seen as the voice for their own experience, writers during the Harlem Renaissance often dedicated their work to Langston Hughes. So we're going to talk a little bit first about the Harlem Renaissance.
Yes.
Do you know anything about the Harlem Renaissance?
I know that a lot of times it's not considered one of the great periods in American art that we typically think of, you know, like when you're thinking mm-hmm. of the Hudson School, Bauhaus, like all of those other movements. I feel like the Harlem Renaissance isn't always included in that, but it was. It's mm-hmm. responsible for like a lot of what Black culture wound up being
yes.
later on, mm-hmm. Especially when you're thinking about like music, plays, mm-hmm. well, theater in general, poetry, writing.
Art, yeah.
Art in general.
Right.
You know, visual arts too. That's typically where my background comes from. So poetry is a little bit newer for me. But I honestly would credit the Harlem Renaissance with like being for why hip hop and rap is where it is now.
Absolutely.
As a genre and just how we've paved our own kind of, just made our own way of entertaining mm-hmm. and proving that like we are just as societally inclined and artistically inclined as everybody else.
Yes, for sure. So the Harlem, the Harlem Renaissance was an intellectual and cultural revival of African-American music, dance, art, fashion, literature, theater, politics, and scholarship centered in Harlem, Manhattan, New York, in New York City. It spanned the 1920s and 30s. At that time, it was known as the New Negro Movement, which then got its name from the New Negro anthology book by Alan Locke. Mm-hmm. The movement also included the new African-American cultural expressions across urban areas in the Northeast and in the Midwest of the United States, the areas that were affected by the renewed militants of in the general struggle of civil rights. It was combined with the Great Migration, which we talked about in our James Baldwin episode. Mm-hmm. His mother had come up to New York in the Great Migration from the South. And a lot of the people who came up from the South, their final destination ended up being Harlem. Mm-hmm. So it ended up being a lot of Black people. And it's still like that. Harlem is still predominantly Black.
Yep. Luckily. Still, gentrified quite a bit, but... Mm-hmm. Because we know it as the cultural center it is, it's mm-hmm. remained pretty.
Yes. so Langston, his ancestry is kind of a little bit complex because he has his paternal great grandmothers were enslaved Africans, and his paternal great grandfathers were their slave owners. Mm. In Kentucky. So he kind of, his ancestry is a little muddy. Mm-hmm. He was born to a mother, Caroline, they called her Carrie, and she was a school teacher. And his father's name was James Nathaniel Hughes. And Langston was the second of two children. He was born in 1901 or 1902. He says it's 1902, but there are some records that say that it's 1901, but we're just going to say 1901. Mm-hmm. And he was born in Joplin, Missouri. And he grew up in several Midwestern small towns. His father left the family when he was a young boy, and his parents got divorced. And he moved. His father was traveling around kind of looking for a place to settle where he felt like racism wasn't so... He wasn't being oppressed so much. So he ended up in Mexico. Mm-hmm. After the separation, Hughes' mother traveled. She traveled looking for employment. And Langston was raised mainly in Lawrence, Kansas, by his maternal grandmother, Mary Patterson. And Lawrence, Kansas is where Sam and Dean are from. Supernatural.
I did not know that.
His grandmother, she was a great influence on him. And through the Black American oral tradition and drawing on the activist experiences in her generation, Mary instilled in her grandson a lasting sense of racial pride. And she just made him feel proud to be Black.
Right.
She made him feel like there wasn't nothing wrong with being Black. Mm-hmm. And he identified with the neglected and the downtrodden people that were around his life, and he wanted to glorify them in his work. And that's what he did. That's where he got a lot of his portrayals.
Yeah. And I think at the time it was just, I think part of like people, a part of his contemporaries back when he was doing his poetry was, the whole point was they have felt like they had a lot to prove as Black artists and just having that label in general. And something really great that I think Langston Hughes and a lot of the Harlem Renaissance creators wound up doing was not sacrificing their experiences for mainstream success.
Yes.
Like, there is a way to make first-class 20th century art about Black people without mimicking their white counterparts.
And that's something that he really strived to do that. He really strived to just highlight the Black person, Black people's regular lives. They didn't have to be like, you didn't have to be someone special or do anything. It was just like regular.
He didn't have to be inventive. He wasn't trying to show the absolute extraordinary pinnacle.
That reminds me a lot of Jordan Peele. I listened to I listened to a Smartless podcast, and he was interviewed on there, and he said that the new movie that he put out, Nope, he was like, it's just a movie about aliens with Black people. Like, they're not, it's not.
It's not some profound
no,
thing.
No, yeah. He's like,
with it's all just of these racial undertones.
Right. He's like, it's just a movie about aliens that it stars Black people.
Exactly.
So, and that's something that I think I don't know if he even mentioned Langston Hughes, but that very much.
But you know what,
looking into this, that reminded me a lot of that.
I get the sentiment, though. Even as a Black person, like, it's hard not to read too deep into the themes of movies that center around us, because for so long everything has been so deep.
Right.
Even though that is what we're craving. We just want regular-ass movies with Black people in them. Like, it doesn't have to be all this, like, you know, just, it doesn't have to be about oppression. I know it already. I don't need to be reminded of it. But it's hard when those movies do come out to just take it for what it is at face value. Like, even, like, when I left the theater, too, you know, me and Kawan were on our phones trying to figure out, like, okay, what is the alien mean? As far like, as like us some as a community, background, like, what is this? And it's like, nothing.
What does it mean for the culture? And it's like, nothing.
Nothing.
It's
just enjoy
a movie about Black aliens with Black people in it. That's
and I'm
it.
Like, damn, you're right. I should just enjoy it. But you can't. Because for so long, everything
had a background.
Everything.
Meaning.
Even when they changed the color of a character, everything got something going on with it. Mm-hmm. So I've got to figure that out. So, yeah, I like that.
So after the death of his grandmother, Langston went to live with friends, James and his Aunt Mary Reed for 2 years. Mm. And then he moved back with his mother, Carrie, in Lincoln, Illinois. She had remarried when he was an adolescent, and the family moved to the Fairfax neighborhood of Cleveland, Ohio, where he attended Central High School and was taught by Mary Helen Chestnut, who he found very inspiring. And she was like a teacher of Latin American descent, and she was an author, and she was just a really big influence in his life. Mm. And she was really pretty if you look her up.
She was hot.
Mm-hmm. His writing experiments really began when he was young. When he was in grammar school, he would write like little poems and stuff. He was elected class poet, and he stated that in retrospect, he felt like they only picked him because he was Black. And then he says, this is a quote from him, he says, "I was a victim of a stereotype. There are only two of us Negro kids in the whole class, and our English teacher was always stressing the importance of rhythm in poetry. While everyone knows except us that all Negroes have rhythm, so they elected me class poet."
Mm-hmm.
Which means it's not our fault. We can find the beat.
I don't even, so I have this theory.
Some of us don't have rhythm because Robert can't dance, baby.
But see, that's, I feel like we all, I don't really care what race you are. I feel like we all are born with an inherent sense of rhythm. Mm-hmm. But I think culturally, the way music is, time signature wise.
Nurtured, yeah.
Yeah, I think that the way like different cultures music just comes out, you're either on the downbeat or the upbeat, period. And some cultures might be on the upbeat, whereas others, like Black people, we'd be on the down.
Right.
So it looks like you're offbeat. It's like you're not. You do have rhythm. It's just different, girl. I'm choosing to believe this. I don't care. Mm-hmm. We all have rhythm.
So, unfortunately, Langston had a pretty poor relationship with his father, who he seldom saw when he was a child. His father lived briefly in Mexico in 1919. Upon graduating from high school in June of 1920, Hughes returned to Mexico to live with his father, hoping to convince him to support his plan to attend Columbia University. Hughes later said that prior to arriving in Mexico, his father had hoped that he would choose to go study abroad. Mm-hmm. He wanted him to go study abroad and be an engineer. On the grounds that he was willing to provide financial assistance, but he didn't want to do that. Langston was like, I don't want to go study abroad and be an engineer.
I'm not going no place.
Yeah. Because his father did not support his writing career. Of course, but parents, you got to support what your kids are into.
Yeah, I think that a lot of times people don't think of their kids as like fully fledged humans that may want something different. And so when it doesn't work out like they've planned, it's a problem. Mm-hmm.
So eventually they came to a compromise where Hughes would study engineering, but he would attend a Columbia University. And his father agreed to that, but he only stayed for a year.
Wow.
Like, yeah, I don't like it. Mm-hmm. While at Columbia University in 1921, he managed to maintain a B average. He published poetry in the Columbia Daily Specter under a pen name. And he left in 1922 because of racial prejudice among the students and teachers. He was denied a room on campus because he was black, and eventually he settled at Hartley Hall. But he still suffered from racism among his classmates, who seemed hostile to anyone who didn't fit into, like, you know, their little square box.
Mm-hmm.
He was attracted more to the African-American people of the neighborhood in Harlem and to his studies, and he continued writing poetry. And Harlem was the center of that, like, it was really coming alive. So he was like, I'm going to Harlem. Columbia, this ain't it.
Yeah.
Y'all not it. I'm going to Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
So he first published in 1921, The Crisis, in the magazine The Crisis. He published The Negro Speaks of Rivers. And The Crisis magazine was the official magazine of the NAACP, which is the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And The Negro Speaks of Rivers became Hughes' signature poem and was collected in his first poetry book, The Weary Blues, that came out in 1926. His first and last poems were published in The Crisis, and this was a journal that he would use throughout his whole career. It was like one that he would come back to all the time.
Okay.
And so I'm just going to read the poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, because I really like it. And I think that it kind of touches on, I think it's for everybody, not just for anybody who's traveled.
Mm-hmm.
If you feel like you've not physically traveled, I mean, like, your life's been a travel. That's what this poem's about.
Yeah.
So it says, this is The Negro Speaks of Rivers by Langston Hughes. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawn were young. I built my hut near the Congo and lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusty rivers. My soul grows deep like the rivers. And that's The Negro Speaks of Rivers by Langston Hughes. I really like that poem.
It's gorgeous.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It speaks so much. There's so much to unpack in that one poem. Like, just of, no, like, and not just, again, not just for black people, like, just anyone, if your life has been a travel. And he's just like, I have been down some rivers, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be rough. So it's just a very pretty poem. Hughes and his contemporaries, they had different goals and aspirations than the black middle class. Hughes and his fellows tried to depict the low life art in his art, the real lives of black people in lower social economical strata. They criticized the divisions and the prejudices in the black community based on skin color, which I literally, that gets under my skin. Mm. Like, you're light skin, dark skin, you're not black enough. Like, that just that drives me insane. We're black. It doesn't matter if you're light or dark. What is the problem?
I think historically it's mattered. And we know about colorism. There's a difference in how you're treated.
Shadeism.
Yeah. Like, I mean, and it could have to do with romantic preferences, who gets chosen to go to what schools, who is allowed to, you know, have certain privileges. And it's, again, I mean, and it goes through all communities. It's about your proximity to whiteness.
Right.
So it matters. Just sucks. Because I think nowadays we probably perpetuate it a little bit more. But you still see it. Like, for example, when they're on social media outcrying for more representation, and then you see who they pick to represent.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
How does this work? Usually, and you see it more with women. Like,
yes, absolutely.
You know, they put dark-skinned men in everything.
Mm-hmm.
But dark-skinned women they don't use. It's very telling. It matters. And I know plenty of really dark-skinned black girls that was called all kinds of porch monkey, gorilla, nappy-headed African booty scratches growing up. That shit real. Mm-hmm. They all right, though. Now.
Things are different now.
Yeah, a little bit. But I feel like a lot of times people even just deny that.
Right.
Like, these days, they'll act like that stuff didn't happen. It's like, no, I was there.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, and that kind of, luckily, didn't happen to me. But I'm not going to act like I didn't see that shit.
Right.
I know how you were treated. Even think about your grandmother and your parents and people in your family. Summertime. Oh, don't stay outside too long. You'll get too dark. What is that? I know Jamaicans right now still bleaching their skin. Right now.
Right
2022. Now. They act like that shit don't happen. I'm like, oh, no.
It's real.
It's real. Like COVID.
Langston's poetry and fiction portrayed the lives of the working class blacks in America. Lives he portrayed as a full of struggle, joy, laughter, and music. Permeating his work is pride in African American identity and diverse culture.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a quote from him. He says, "My seeking has been to explain and illuminate the Negro condition in America. Oblique that all humankind feel good." So I just think that he just really wanted to. He wasn't ashamed of. Obviously, wasn't ashamed of being black, but he didn't want to. Again, he wasn't like, we are something. Us being regular is something that should be praised.
Right.
You know, just our regular lives.
Just us existing.
Uh huh. Right.
Even though that existence is different.
Mm-hmm.
It is still relatable nonetheless. You don't have to, other it.
Right.
Which is typically how it goes. Mm-hmm. You're othered. And so your experiences are seen as like exotic or something. And it's like, no, not really. You're making it that.
Right. After attending Columbia University, he explored Harlem, forming permanent attachment in what he called the Great Dark City. He worked as a steward on a freighter boat bound for Africa. Back in New York, after seafaring in Europe, he met, in 1924, the writers Arne Bontemps and Carl Van Vechten. That's definitely not how you say his name. Sorry, Carl. With whom he had lifelong friendships with. He won an Opportunity magazine poetry prize in 1925, and that same year Van Vechten introduced Hughes' poetry to a publisher, Alfred Knopf. I don't know how to say that. Anyway, he accepted Hughes' poetry, and then they published of The Weary Blues, his collection in 1926. How cool is that, that he worked on a boat?
It's cool. Very dangerous.
Yes.
That's all I'm
Seth
thinking.
Seth worked on a boat.
Dangerous. Congrats on still being here, Seth.
Right.
Period.
And happy birthday.
And happy birthday. But yeah, because this doesn't come out until Wednesday, so his birthday will pass by then. Cool. Easy.
While working as a busboy in a hotel in Washington, D.C. in late 1925, this is a cute story. He put three of his poems beside the plate of Vachel Lindsay in the dining room. And then the next day, she loved the poems, which is such a cute way to, like, I'm just going to put these right here.
He did a lot of things like that. Like, I was even reading about him, like, you would meet him one day, and he would get to know you a little bit. You might find out, you know, when your birthday was or whatever, and he would have his secretary, like, at the beginning of the year, just write out all of these birthday cards for people who he'd met, and then instruct them on when to send them so that they arrived right on time for people. And it wasn't necessarily, like, his best friends or anything. Like, these would be, like the guy at the butcher shop or, like, the mailman or, like, people who he just met being out and about, because he would take all these long nightly walks. And, like, imagine you get a letter from Langston Hughes on your damn birthday. You know what I mean? Like, you'd have let this man.
Oh, my God.
You know what I mean? That shit is crazy. But he, yeah, I love that. Personal touches.
Yes. So the next day, newspapers around the country reported that Lindsay had found she was among the most popular of the poets in that day, and she had discovered him. And which, but it had earned him, like, a lot of a really broad notice. And he received a scholarship to attend Lincoln University in Pennsylvania in 1926. In that same year, he received the Witter Bynner Undergraduate Poetry Award. And he published The Negro Artist and The Racial Mountain in The Nation, which is that magazine that James Baldwin had also used. He had published some stuff in The Nation, too. It's the old, it's the successor of an old abolitionist magazine that was run during Civil War times. So, but it just has a lot of up-and-coming artists or, like, poets and stuff like that. So definitely really, really cool. By the time he received his degree in 1929, he had helped launch Fire, and that was a magazine of his own. And that was an American magazine that exerted, like, it was all about the Harlem Renaissance. And its first issue came out in November in 1926, and it was like a journal for American literature and, like, political ideas, and that's where everybody, like, you know, that's where black people got their news. And it was Langston Hughes was the writer, and Richard Nugent was the graphic designer, and they had the editorial board that had Zora Neale Hurston on it, Gwendolyn Bennett, John Davis, Aaron Douglas, and then just a whole slew of people, and they got together and they put this magazine together.
That's crazy.
Yeah, just some heavy hitters.
Yeah, no, I remember hearing about him, like, in different, like, poetry slams and spoken word, and, like, you know, James Earl Jones. His dad would be, like, leading some of these.
No way.
I'm like, what the fuck? Like, y'all just out here.
What?
Hanging out.
That's crazy.
Like, just crazy. I mean, really, we know them as heavy hitters now, but I'm sure at the time, like,
they were just chilling.
These are cool, you know, bohemian people.
Right.
In Harlem at the time, trying to, like, make sure y'all know we make good art too, period.
So in 1927, he published his second collection of poetry, which is Fine Clothes to the Jew, which was criticized by some for its title and for its frankness, though Hughes himself felt that it represented another step forward in his writing. So he didn't give a shit, fuck y'all.
Yeah. Well, they'll come out with that real quick, but...
A few months after graduating, A few months after Hughes' graduation, he put out his first prose volume, which was Not Without Laughter, in 1930. It had a cordial reception. In 1930s, he turned his poetry into more of, like, a force, more of racial justice and more of political radicalism. He was really, he wasn't sugarcoating nothing anymore. He was like going for it.
I feel like there's always that period.
Yeah, you're like, this is it.
No, yeah. I mean, I think that after a while you do become disenchanted and like you're affected by your environment. And so when things happen, you go from like that kumbaya, let's right. all get along to like, actually, why are y'all like this?
Like, yeah. Like, what's really wrong with y'all?
Because what if I just beat you up?
Then what?
Literally, I don't know. So yeah, I feel like there's always that point.
He traveled to South America in 1931. He did a lot of traveling. He went to the Soviet Union. He went to Haiti. He went to Japan. And he served as the newspaper correspondent in 1937 during the Spanish Civil War. Mm-hmm. He published a collection of short stories, "The Ways of White Folks," in 1934, and he became deeply involved in the theater. His play Mulatto, adapted from his short stories, premiered on Broadway in 1935, and productions of several other plays followed in the late 1930s. He was also founded theater companies in Harlem in 1937 and in Los Angeles in 1939. Mm. In 1940, Hughes published The Big C, his autobiography, up to age 28, and then a second autobiography, I Wonder Why I Wander, was published in 1956. Which I love when they do autobiography, because it's such good to get it from their mouth.
It is. And I think that they can put like a lot of time into it and allows them to like unpack their past.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite things when we did our episode on Maya Angelou, because she wrote so much about her own life.
Yeah.
So it was so interesting to get like her actual words.
Yeah, and it's just stuff that she never would have said at the time.
Right.
And like, or maybe she just didn't have the ability to speak on it at that
right.
time. And looking back on it, it can be cathartic. Like, I feel the same way about people who journal throughout their lives, and then they have these journals to like look back at and like see how their perspective has changed. I think it's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
I should do that. But I feel like I don't be thinking anything. I don't know.
And Hughes, some people say that he was gay. One thing I liked about that also, that he never confirmed or denied it. So he always left everybody like, you never gonna know.
Yeah.
Always in the dark.
It's not anyone's business.
Really, it's really not.
You know, unless you up in there.
But he would use a lot of sexual codes in his poems.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to whatever you think. It's up to, it's, he never confirmed or denied it, so.
It is what it is.
Right. But he did, his career was amazing. He was such a great poet and author. He did so much for so many different, he was such an advocate for Black people and for artists.
Yes, for artists in the community who were coming up, like, way later into his life, too. Like, just, he saw the value in it, and he would be out there, you know. They couldn't name a single person who hadn't been mentored by Langston Hughes.
Yes.
Which I think is good. You know, you see a lot of artists, they kind of like make their way through after they've gone through all the drudgery of trying to make it, and then they don't really reach back and extend a hand to those people who need to learn.
Right.
So always good to hear.
And he was just, his popularity among the younger generation of Black people varied in the increasing years from like the 1950s and 60s. But it gradually advanced when like that new, the 60s came up and the new, you know, Black people coming back together and all that stuff in the 60s.
Yeah, like during Black is Beautiful and all that. It was kind of like the second
wave.
Yeah,
like a revival of him. So he found some new writers. He touched again with James Baldwin. I feel like all of these writers we listen to, it always come back to James Baldwin. I'm happy that we did him first.
Well, yeah.
Because I feel like
Jimmy was popular.
He was just we keep coming back to him. He wanted young Black writers to be objective about their race, not to hate it, just talk about it. These are your things.
Mm-hmm.
But he understood like the main points of like the Black Power movement. He didn't want to ignore it, but he like didn't want to dwell on it either.
Mm-hmm.
So he just wanted to make art. He really wasn't about anything else. He just wanted to make art. But he was also wanted to, like, show the plight of others. You know what I mean?
Yes.
He was drawn to communism as an alternative to segregation in America. He was his lesser known political view. It was one of his lesser known political views. In 1932, he became part of a group of black people who were sent to the Soviet Union to make a film about the plight of African Americans in the United States. The film was never made. They never allowed it to get done. But Hughes was given the opportunity to travel and, like, learn. So this was his, like, during his traveling time. He traveled to Central Asia. Excuse me. And while he was there, he met Robert Robinson, an African-American living in Moscow who wasn't able to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was something that he kind of, that rubbed him the wrong way. And so that, like, he was always advocating for that. He would always, like, bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime he was, like, in an audience,
mm-hmm.
he would always advocate for that. So he was just very well aware of, you know, everything that's going on around him.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a, he did a lot for the community as well. He did a lot. He was able to do so much for, like, the black community and the artist community together
mm-hmm.
and really bring them together. So I think that he did a lot for poetry as well. Because mm-hmm. I didn't read a lot of poetry. Poetry wasn't really something that I read.
No, it wasn't really encouraged.
No.
And it's one of those genres of art where for a black person, it's just so riddled with our trauma and,
mm-hmm.
you know, hurt and oppression and everything. So it can be a thing where if you feel like you haven't gone through a lot of that stuff, you kind of shy away from it. You may feel like you don't have as much of a powerful story to tell. I don't know what the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
But poetry was such a heavy thing growing up. I don't think I really leaned into that as much as maybe I should have, maybe. Maybe I could have enjoyed it more.
In 1960, the NAACP awarded Hughes the Spingren Medal for Distinguished Achievements by an African American.
Mm-hmm.
In 1963, he was awarded an honorary doctorate from Howard University. And in 1964, he was awarded an honorary literary doctorate from Western Reserve University. So I think he's another one where, like Maya Angelou, where it's like they've done so much. They didn't need to go to college because they've just experienced so much,
mm-hmm.
and that's worthless. Like learn, I would love to sit and learn or listen to whatever they have to say, even though
yeah,
they didn't go to, like, you didn't have to go to college. They've experienced so much.
Those kinds of things don't really mm-hmm. fit in didactic spaces anyway.
Right.
Just the methods of teaching that they usually use is right. not. How they teach, so it doesn't really fit there anyway. It's different.
Right. And then this is another poem that I'm going to read by Langston Hughes. I think is really pretty. It's called My People. And it's in his, it was published in his book, The Crisis, in October 1923. And it says, "The night is beautiful, so the faces of my people. The stars are beautiful, so the eyes of my people. Beautiful also is the sun. Beautiful also are the souls of my people." And I love that. I like that poem too. And I think I really like his poems because he, like, they're short and sweet. Like, he really gets to the point and they are very moving.
And they're excerpts you can just remember.
And that too.
They're very much, you're able to memorize them.
Mm-hmm.
Bring them up, reference them.
Yes.
Mm.
On May 22nd, 1967, Langston Hughes died at Soviet Polyclinic in New York at the age of 66 from complications after abdominal surgery related to prostate cancer. His ashes were interred beneath the floor of a medallion in the middle of the foyer at the Shurcom Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem. Mm. It is the entrance of the auditorium named after him. The design in the floor is an African cosmogram entitled Rivers. And the title is taken from his poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, which I read earlier. Mm-hmm. And that is the history of Langston Hughes.
Nice.
I love, he made me like, I want to say like not like poetry because I've always liked poetry, but like mm-hmm. he made me like sit down and like read poetry.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like actually want to take in a book of poetry. I've never like been like looking for a book of poetry, but mm-hmm. I might actually do that now.
I like looking at his work as like the dawn of like that, the spoken word that we get now,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the jazz beat in the background, mm-hmm. you know, under an overtone of music, like very much theatrical. Almost with, like, you know, with dance accompaniments, like, just turning it into theater itself. So I love that. And I think he made me, I think he didn't make me like poetry more, but I appreciate it more
mm-hmm.
For the way it's able to convey the stuff that, like, we usually put in hundreds and hundreds of pages of books.
Yeah.
And he's able to get that down to, like, 30 seconds.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, he's able to just get him, get his poetry is very like short and sweet, but he's very powerful. Yeah, really, he really is. So that is the history of Langston Hughes. I got a lot of my information from botanica.com and from the poetryfoundation.org has all of his poems. Mm-hmm. So if you want to look at some of his poetry, you should go there and check that out.
Mm-hmm.
It's poetryfoundation.org, and I'll put the link in the show notes, too. And he has so many good poems that are just short. And he just, another one who's, like, lived such a crazy life.
Yeah.
And just all his traveling and worked on a boat, and then, like, but you're a poet? That's just so crazy to me.
Yeah, and all of his work is based on those experiences. Mm-hmm. So. Oh, love that.
And he was just, he was, like, a nice person. Like, people actually liked him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you get, some artists are, like, dicks.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, he was, like, actually a really nice person. So, that I really did enjoy. Yeah, that was the history of Langston Hughes. And that was our show for today.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget to check us out on Instagram. We are at. I was just about to say The Anxious Tomato. So What Are You Reading podcast on Instagram. And we have a So What Are You Reading private Facebook group. So you can definitely check us out there.
Yes. Check out our LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. Our questionnaire is there. Mm-hmm. Our Spotify and Apple. I think, is Apple Podcast
on? No, but we're going to.
Yeah, we're going to add that on there.
Yeah, we're going to add that. And there's a link I'm going to send Lee the link so that she can hook it up to our all of the book recommendations from all of our guests. I have them all typed up
on a spreadsheet.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So you guys can check out any of the recommendations from all of our previous guests
on our ever-growing list.
Yes, if you're looking for a book to read, they're all right there.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely check that out. And don't forget to check out The Anxious Tomato, of course. They are theanxioustomato.com. We have the true crime show coming up in April. When this episode comes out, it'll be April. I mean, it'll be, oh my God, April, I wish. It'll be November. And the true crime show comes out. And some of the pics, some of the demonstrations that came in are really creepy. I'm like, did you murder someone for this?
Maybe they know someone.
Hope you murder someone just for this artist yeah, okay, show.
Give me an example.
Just like bodies, but like they look very. Like, I feel like you might have murdered someone for this.
Well, you know that's a tradition in art where they would take, like, cadavers from, like, the medical facilities Lord. Or from morgues to draw them from life. Caravaggio did that a lot.
Oh. He was a weirdo.
He'd have, like, because, well, that was a thing back in the day. Like, in the early 19th century, mm-hmm. you could be, like, a, it was kind of, like, equated to the same job as, like, if you were to scrape roadkill off the side of the road. But you could be, in a way, I forgot the actual term, but they were, like, grave robbers, essentially. They would go out for hospitals. They would get paid by, like, hospitals, medical institutions, researchers to go and get fresh bodies from their graves, of, like, poor people, the homeless, sex workers, whatever. Get those cadavers, bring them back to them.
Oh, like the Burke and Hare murders.
Kind of. So that they could, you know, operate on them, do their medical tests, their research, whatever. Artists would also do that.
Mm.
Except they might go to the hospital and be like, hey, got any loose heads around here? I'm painting the thing. I need some heads. Like, you know, whatever things they would do in the night to get the shot. But
nice.
However you get it.
You got to do it.
Do what you got to do.
But you should definitely check out that the true crime show that's going to be at the Anxious Tomato in November. And you can check them out for all of their previous artists of the month. They're all archived there. So if you're looking for some good art to check out, go check them out there. I highly suggest that. And if you are looking to get a picture framed or you're looking for art, you can check out Art Co-Framing and Gallery. They are in Tacoma, here in Tacoma, Washington. Or you can check them out at artcoframinggallery.com. Mm-hmm. They're a great resource for artists in the community, and they also do framing. You can frame your art, or you can just get your own picture framed if you need that. They do custom frames. Go in there and talk to them. Jennifer is the owner. She's an amazing woman, and she can get you all hooked up. So do that if you are looking for a frame, or if you're looking to just connect with the artist community here in Tacoma. We're trying to get us together.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot of stuff. The Anxious Tomato Collective has a lot of really good stuff coming up for the artist community in Tacoma. So be prepared, guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep reading.
Or don't. You don't have to. But, like, I'm going to keep doing it. So.
Yes. Stay safe.
Yeah. Stay safe on Halloween.
Yes.
If possible.
Happy Halloween.
I'm so excited.
I'm so excited.
Am I really in the Halloween spirit, though? I don't know. It's just something to do.
I can't wait to take my son trick-or-treating and watch all the kids.
Yeah, I'm excited. That's what I'm excited about.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing these costumes.
Yeah. So happy Halloween. Be safe. Don't do anything stupid. Don't blow your hand off. I feel like people do dumb things on Halloween.
Yeah, don't get hurt.
Dumb.
There are
I'm just going into my mom's speech now.
Yeah, like, it's true. Like, our medical staff, they're already overloaded. Can y'all not?
Yeah.
Let's stay out of the ER, people.
Yeah. But you guys have a great night, and we will talk to you next weekend.
Ooh, ooh.
Bye.
Bye.